If you are sitting at home next to your radio, you're hearing the music faster than you are if you're in the hall.
Listening for the secret, searching for the sound. This is the Sound Podcast with Ira Haberman.
Before we get to today's show, I wanted to tell you all about the new SoundStream app. It is the new home for all things sound podcast, and now you're able to listen to the perfect blend of music you'd expect from us 24/7. Jam bands and more, much more. New episodes of the podcast arrive at least 3 times a week, and now you can listen to your favorite artists and bands all the time in a perfect music stream. Just hit the play button and away you go. You'll be boogieing in no time. You can make requests, offer shoutouts, and even let us know when your birthday is, all from the SoundStream app. Get the app at thesoundstream.com or in the Apple or Google Play Store. The show starts now.
To aim for what you
You've been listening to Magnolia Road from the Almond Betts Band off their forthcoming release, Bless Your Heart, due out August 28th. I've had the pleasure of talking with Devin Almond and Dwayne Betts, both individually and together, both on the phone and in person. Each interaction has been totally cool, as both dudes are extremely cool and so knowledgeable and creative. It's a testament not only to their lineage, but likely more importantly, insight into their love of their craft and this project that, while still exciting, isn't as fresh as it once was. On August 28th, the Almond Betts Band will release Bless Your Heart, only a year since their debut, Down to the River. Bless Your Heart, though their sophomore album, is hardly sophomoric. It is filled with a series of great tunes, performances, and great vibes. What more can you ask for from the seven-piece outfit that's fronted by two solid individuals? We caught up with Devin and Dwayne and dived quite deeply into the new album, but the conversation started when I asked what the impetus was to put out a new record so close to the first album's release just over a year ago.
I think once we kind of got out there, we didn't really want to waste any time, for one. For two, you know, our heroes used to put out a record a year. And we're a new band, but we're not in our 20s. So we want to put out a record a year when we can, you know, would be great. Maybe every year and a half. We went right back to the way we did Down to the River writing, which was summertime, early fall, bring Stahl Vaughn out, a collaborator. And whenever we got those free hour or two or three, you know, hour windows on the bus, backstage, hotel, and we had some leftovers from Down to the River, and it was like, you know what? If they didn't make it, they didn't make it for a reason. So we kind of started from scratch, you know?
You also changed the lineup a little bit. I mean, you added Barry Oakley to the lineup. He wasn't on the first record.
Nope.
He was on the first record?
Yep. Same lineup. The only cat that was different was we had Peter Levin from my father's band on keyboards.
Yeah.
Played on Down to the River. It's okay. There's a lot of dudes. It's hard to keep track. Yeah. And then Peter, you know, at the final hour was like, man, I don't think I want to be in a full-time band. So we hired John Genty.
How was it going back to Muscle Shoals to record this record? Was it essential that you went back there?
It just felt like the right thing to do. You know, it felt comfortable. It felt like, you know, for your second record, you don't need to change up everything. If it worked the first time, then maybe it'll work even better the second time. And I think what you were saying was kind of a statement to that, that it sounds like a sequel, but it's definitely the next step or maybe even a couple steps. So, yeah, I mean, it felt familiar. It felt like the homecoming a little bit because we worked there. We had a good feel for the room and the, you know, playing with seven guys in a room, recording live like the way we do. And Matt Ross Spang was an integral part of the process. Of course, he has great instinct and knowledge of, you know, a vast knowledge of music. And so it was awesome going back, you know. It's a legendary place, and you feel it the moment you walk through the door.
How important is it to capture that live thing off the floor on 2-inch tape? I mean, is that the most authentic recording experience you guys can get to at this point? Is it better than, and I know that there were some overdubs and some additional tracking in Memphis and St. Louis, but actually being able to record to 2-inch tape live off the floor in Muscle Shoals, does it get any more authentic than that, Devin?
You know, I think for the style of the songs, that's the best way to go. You know, there's two ways to make a record when you're recording, you know, a full band, and that's to stack your tracks and have one cat go at a time after the drums are captured. And that is a really great method, 2-inch or digital, for heavy metal, pop, for rap, for progressive, like Rush, like a Rush record would, you know what I mean? So with these kinds of songs, with this style of music, man, I think having that air in the room, having the bleed over into the, you know, a little shimmer of the cymbal is coming through the guitar mics, and, you know, those things are about as authentic as it gets sonically, you know, not just overall, like, is that the authentic way to do it? I think sonically, it's the most authentic way to capture it. And that's how they did it in the old days. Good enough for them, good enough for us.
It's kind of like you're not just recording instruments, you're recording the actual, the room, you know? So everything's kind of, you know, there's all these parts, but it's, you're also recording the one main thing that, you know, the room, you know? I think Keith Richards talked about that. And but yeah, there, everything Devin said, definitely, I feel the same way.
And you're capturing the performance, not just the song.
Right. So how many were these, was it take one every time, or were there multiple takes and you chose the best ones? Like, I'm sure that there were songs that you guys nailed right away. And then there were songs that you probably had to do a few times, like Savannah's Dream, because it's so complicated. I would imagine wasn't a one take, a one trick, one take pony. It kind of probably was a few takes before you got that right.
It's hard to remember, but I'll say this. I don't think, you know, and this isn't to, like, you know, puff our chest out, but mm-hmm. I don't recall any songs going past like a fourth take. Most of the songs you'd buzz through it, and we discuss and we tweak with Matt Ross Fang. And by the second or the third, that was the one. I want to say Savannah was the second run, Dwayne.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the tune. You know, some of these songs we'd played live, so we didn't really need to rehearse them. Or we'd rehearse them at soundcheck and not played live in our set. There was a few songs that we hadn't done either. You know, so those songs, we kind of had to do a quick rehearsal and get a feel for them before we hit the record button. So, in other words, it might have been take three, but we played it three or four times before we even started recording, you know.
Right.
But Savannah, yeah, I think Savannah was right around that third or fourth take. I mean, we didn't spend time trying to get it perfect, you know. You just get it to where it feels right, and it's a good representation, and it's great, you know. It doesn't need to be, you know, there's nothing wrong with having something be a great starting point to where it could go live. I mean, if you spend 6 months playing it on the road, then it's going to go places that it wouldn't go the first day that you're playing it in the studio, and that's okay, you know. It doesn't have to be that right away. So but yeah, usually we'd get them in the first five takes, I'd say.
What I find so amazing about all your music is how tasteful it is that you give, you know, John Ginty a place to shine. You give Stashla a place to shine. You give each of you a place to shine. I mean, over and over again, you get to know all the members of the band, and it's a seven-piece band, but you get to know everybody in this band, whether it's the two of you trading off guitar parts or Johnny's parts or whatever. How important is that this is a band? This isn't just a, you know, the Dwayne Betts, Devin Allman show, that this is a complete band of guys that can all play.
Well, I mean, you know, they cut us checks every time they get a solo, so. And, you know, I think, again, you know, I you know, it's obvious, you know, Dwayne and my name and Dwayne's name is on the band, but it's a band. It's a seven-piece band. And really, I kind of always say it, at the end of the day, the song is the boss. And I think that we're long enough in the tooth now that we know when there's a special moment for Ginty to open that section up. We know where in what type of song that Johnny's slide guitar is going to be the perfect commas and apostrophes in the dialogue. And thankfully we have so many great cats, you know, R. Scott Bryan on, you know, the percussion. We just have, thankfully at our disposal, we have a seven piece band that, you know, and it just all falls right into place. And we don't have to spend a lot of time assigning those parts. Dwayne and I kind of know when we write it, we're like, oh, in that spot, like it just reveals itself. It's very organic. And we're really blessed to have such great cast.
Yeah. Speaking of R. Scott, one thing that I think is a really cool part of this record, some of the percussion parts, the way they fit with the drums are really, really unique and cool, especially like his part in Pale Horse Rider is kind of actually has kind of a Phil Spector kind of wall of sound kind of thing to it. And I don't know. I just thought I'd point that out.
That's great. Why don't we hop in, if you guys don't mind, why don't we hop into some of the songs that people have heard already, but people will be hearing in the not too distant future, because there are many of them that stand out to my ears. We've already mentioned the excellent instrumental that is Savannah's Dream, and it follows in the long line of other instrumentals by people with the similar last name as Dwayne's. Let's talk about a few others. Magnolia Road is interesting to me because it's not a song either of you wrote, right? It's a song that Stoll wrote, but it probably is very autobiographical for both of you in terms of the imagery in the song and the way the song sounds in terms of it sonically being very similar to a band song or a Grateful Dead song. I'm curious how in your head is Stoll that he's able to come up with Magnolia Road?
Well, no, I think Stoll is a very astute storyteller. He's now been in our circle. He's worked with Dwayne prior to this band, but he's been in our circle now for a couple of years. And I think he knows we're not going to go out of our way to tell, you know, our story. I think there's that a bit of that hesitancy for us to tell our story from the perspective of the sons of these people.
Right.
So it's a lot easier for him to do. And you know, where we might be like, you know, when he brings a song like that, that's very simple and kind of does a really kind of expert job of kind of summing up, you know, who we are, where we've been in just a few short lines. It was pretty hard to deny that one. It wasn't a big, great reveal either. It was pretty surface level stuff. And maybe serves as a good introduction to people that maybe aren't aware of who we are or the band that we have. So, I mean, he's just a good cat. He gets in there and gets that information out there really, really good.
Did you want to add anything to that, Dwayne?
No, everything that he said. I mean, Stoll is very inquisitive. You know, when you meet him he's always looking for a story from someone. If he stops at a gas station in a town when he's driving across the country, he wants to talk to folks, you know, and learn about them, and maybe he'll get a song out of it. That's the kind of songwriter Stoll is. He kind of comes from kind of like a Towns Van Zandt, you know, storyteller. Yeah. And he's really very inquisitive. When you meet him, he'll ask. And part of that, I think, has to do with he's always conscious of maybe he'll get a song out of it. You know?
One song that he had nothing to, I don't know for sure he had nothing to do, but at least he doesn't have a writing credit for, is the second single from the record. And that's Pale Horse Rider, which is the lead off track from this record. It opens ominously. It gets really dark and dense very quickly. And your vocal is very cool on that track as well, Devin. Lots of guitars centered around Dwayne, and the riffs evokes some Neil Young and Crazy Horse and stuff. Was it, when you're sitting in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, writing this song, is all of that kind of coming through, or are you just thinking about the lyrics, not necessarily how the song is going to take shape?
I think that song is just a perfect example of a marriage, like a great marriage of ideas, like coming together, you know, that it just kind of happened simultaneously. It just happened organically. I had this kind of the heavy riff that descends. And then Devin at the same time was playing this minor, the intro part, in Soundcheck. He started playing that. And I didn't make, I actually was making a connection with this other thing he was playing, like, oh, we could add that to this riff I have. But then he came up with the thing that became the intro, and then that married itself together. And then it just went from there. I mean, Devin kind of came up with the storyline, and then with that, I think we did a really good job of not falling victim to the first easy instinct of the arrangement. You know, we made sure that it didn't go, you know, verse, chorus, bridge, solo, what have you.
Yeah.
You know, and that I think is one of the coolest thing. I think that that's the character of that song, is its unique ability to avoid conventional arrangement.
Yeah.
Yeah. We, you know, when we kind of sat down with it and first had the idea of taking his descending lick, that big, gorgeous, you know, descending lick, it was like, you know, well, let's give it some ebb and flow, you know, so let's bring it way down and tell the story. And then I came up with the secondary twin guitar line, the da-do-da-down, da-do-do-down. And then, man, I'm playing this, and I'm like, oh, I'll write words for that later. And then I was like, no, it's kind of cool being a wordless chorus. Like, and that's kind of the moment, the epiphany moment that we had, where I remember telling Dwayne, like, man, the song doesn't need words in the chorus. Like, we don't always have to follow these conventional things. And when we do this twin guitar line, we should just both veer off and still be playing and let it swirl. And right then, I think we both had a good idea of like how this thing was going to come together. And it, that way of thinking that we are now engaged into, I think affected some other things. It was like, let the song just lead the way. And we're really proud of that one, because it is, it, you know, it's not experimental like Frank Zappa-esque, right, but it doesn't follow a conventional arrangement. You know, a wordless chorus and a bunch of guitars.
There's definitely, there's absolutely nothing like that on the first record. I mean, that, and I think you would agree with that. I mean, that's kind of like leaps and bounds,
yeah,
stylistically and everything from the first record. Not that the first record's great, but
I agree. It's about growing and figuring stuff out and not necessarily doing things the way others do it or tell you to do it. It is absolutely about growing. King Crawler is this, wow, great R&B tune. You could talk about, well, first of all, Art Edmonston comes in and plays sax, which is just absolutely amazing. But it is kind of like that Southern rock vibe going across the pond to Britain and then coming back and reinterpreting whatever the Rolling Stones did to Southern rock, right? I mean, that's what King Crawler is.
Yeah, I mean, it's rhythm and blues, really. I mean, it's not, it's just Southern music. I mean,
yeah.
Rock and roll is pretty much Southern music. I think Devin's father had a really funny quote that was something like, saying Southern rock is like saying rock.
Yeah.
Which is kind of an oversimplification of things. I mean, obviously Genesis isn't, you know, doesn't really sound Southern at all, but the Rolling Stones certainly sound like they're influenced by a lot of Southern music.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, that was just a fun tune that Stahl and I started it. We were writing it in Illinois, in Chicago, outside of Chicago somewhere. And we had it to different music. And then I came up with that opening riff. I changed the riff on it. It was more laid back. It kind of had more of a band kind of laid back thing.
Right.
And then we souped it up, hyped it up, and gave it the more of the Stones upbeat thing. And then Devin, we finished it in a hotel room. I think we were in Virginia somewhere, and Devin came in and had some great ideas, and the three of us finished writing it together. So
Yeah, it's a great tune.
It's a rock and roll song.
It's a rock. Well, another rock and roll song on this record is Southern Rain, right? It does have all the markings of some late 70s, early 80s rock as well. And Devin's emotional lyric and it's such a great song, but again, it's another rock song. There's a lot of these on the record. There's little pockets of these great individual rock songs that you hear and you think, oh yeah, it's the Almond Betts band, because you know, after you hear Savannah's Dream or you hear Pale Horse Rider, it's good to remember that you guys are a rock band. You're not here to, you know, you're not here to play 12-minute songs. You're here to rock out and give your fans a good time, right?
Well, I think, you know, the thing I've always said for years is you know, I think I can speak for Dwayne here and the rest of the crew, is we're really fans of the quote-unquote jam bands that were the architects of that movement. And that is the Dead, the Brothers, Santana, the Stones, even in the 60s and 70s. Bands that were song-based that could jam, not these jam bands kind of searching for a song to hang their hat on. Like so I think, number one, we're a song-based band. Number two, we are a rock and roll band. And number three, we have the ability to play and to stretch them out. So something like, you know, the tag on King Crawler with the great sax and Southern Rain, you know, one of the moments on the record where I get to play lead, there's three guitar players. I got to find my spots.
Yeah. Did you write checks for everybody?
What's that?
Did you write checks for everybody?
On that one, they wrote them to me. No, no, it was just, it was really sweet. And I think that one made sense for me to take that lead out. And that one almost gives me more of maybe a Petty vibe or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, Southern Rain is, you know, really the only song that I've ever, you know, kind of, you know, just spoke about losing both parents, you know, in such a short amount of time and being okay with it finally. And knowing that, that Pop's looking down and proud of the work that Dwayne and Barry and I are doing. And, that just kind of came and Stahl really helped, you know, kind of tidy it up with me.
You mentioned laid back approach to one of the riffs early on, and I can't remember. I think you said it was in King Crawler, or maybe it was in Southern Rain. But the thing about Rivers Run is that it is this really laid back, gorgeous. I mean, it's so pretty, the two of you on twin acoustics, and then the very tasteful electric twin guitar playing of Dwayne and Johnny playing twin guitars on the harmony. What more can you say about Rivers Run? It's just a gorgeous tune that does evoke memories of some of those bands that you mentioned. I mean, it's a song, first of all, but it's so reminiscent of the band and of the Almonds and of the Dead, and that very practical way of making music and that very sweet way of making music. How important was that record, that song, for you guys to put on here?
Well, I mean, I kind of wrote that one about my grandmother's property, that my dad bought a piece of property out on the Manatee River in the early 70s, and he built a house for his mom on it. And then later he lived there after he separated from my mom, and then I lived there for a time in my teens with my dad. After my grandmother had passed. But, you know, and he wrote a lot of songs on that property. I know he probably wrote Seven Turns and Where It All Begins. I mean, and a lot of other stuff too, but it just evokes a lot of memories, you know. And Stahl came in and like Devin was saying, I mean, he's really good at taking what you have and then adding to it and making it like twice as good, you know, and saying, you know, and I trust him if I'm like, well, that is better. I guess I have to write it with you then. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
but anyway, yeah, that was just a real sweet song about I don't know, just longing for a familiar place that you remember early in your life that means a lot to you, I guess, you know?
Yeah. And sonically it does that, right? It helps you remember someplace of longing. I want to talk about two more songs. The first one is The Doctor's Daughter, where Barry Dwayne Oakley gets to sing. Did we know that Barry Dwayne Oakley had the chops to sing and do it so well before you guys went into the studio?
Dude, Barry Dwayne Oakley was on tour with Robbie Krieger of The Doors singing all the Morrison shit. Hell wow. Yeah, he could sing.
Yeah,
we knew he could sing. Yeah, there's no doubt about that.
I think in the first record, you know, just to be quite frank, we didn't want to confuse listeners. We didn't want to throw the ball everywhere. It's like, let's establish this son of a bitch, and then it'll unfold a little later, you know? It's the perfect time to bring him in and let him do his thing. He wrote that tune. You know, Dwayne and I tweaked a little bit with him and you know, kind of tidied up some spots. And
we kind of brought in, he had a really great chorus, but we felt like it needed a more of a lift, and it wasn't that the chorus he had. So we kind of rearranged the chorus a little bit, but by all means, I mean, that's his tune, you know?
Yeah. I remember saying, man, that final line of that chorus, that it just ain't enough.
Yeah.
Repeat it.
Yeah,
like,
that was Paul big.
McCartney. You know, Paul McCartney's Kings would have done that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking Harrison, but yes, you're at, any Beatle probably would have done that at some point,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. And it had such a Pink Floyd vibe, which is not our typical, you know, flavor du jour, but I mean, certainly a band that we all cut our teeth on, and having that element on the record makes sense. And seeing Barry get behind the piano and sing it, and I got to play bass on it since there's nobody on the bass. So I think that's going to make a cool moment on stage to kind of do a little switcheroo.
Yeah. Really cool. That's great. So who's the guy with the big baritone voice on Much Obliged? I'm just joking. I know it's you, Devin. I know it's you, but talking about switcheroo and not doing things like you did on the first record.
So it started off as kind of a, you know, kind of a ha-ha kind of moment, like, hey, what if I like Johnny Cash this? And then I can't remember if it was Dwayne or Stahl or maybe both of them, but they're kind of like, you know, man, maybe roll with that.
And
cool. I try to take the humor away and really kind of just marry myself to doing it. It's a weird register for me to kind of lock into, but yeah, not hard, just weird. I'd never really done it.
Yeah.
You know, but when I hear it back, I'm like, wow, okay. You know, we did that.
How was CB? I mean, this COVID-19 thing has allowed you guys to do a couple of things that you probably wouldn't have imagined you'd be doing. The first is playing live for folks without having folks actually in the venue, but playing live and streaming shows. So that must be cool to get these songs out there and for people to know that these songs exist. And the other thing is, playing CBS this morning, so early on in the machination of this band. I mean, it's still pretty early to get that kind of national exposure. Let's start with playing in quarantine on a stream first. Like, was that weird, Devin? Different?
Certainly weird to not have the energy of people in the venue. Definitely just strange. But gotta say, with cameras on you and knowing it's live and knowing there's X number of people watching in that moment, you're still sharing the moment with them. So, you know, it's not like you can stop the song and go, oh, that was a little quick, let's do it again. Which you normally can do when a venue is empty. So that, you know, some weird dynamics there. But, you know, it's kind of one of those, like, better than nothing situations. I'd rather do that than sit on my ass at home, man.
Yeah. I mean, I was just happy to be playing with people, with our band, you know. I mean, we love playing together, whether there's people there or not. Or, I mean, even if there's no one watching, even on a live stream. But, Yeah, I mean, we're in a position right now where that's just what the deal is, and we are adapting to that, and everybody is in the same boat. So
right.
So it makes it easier if you're not sitting on the sidelines watching everybody playing festivals around the world, and you know, and nobody's doing anything. So that's the good part about it.
And how about playing CBS this morning? Although you weren't necessarily in the environs, but just the fact that you were asked to play, I mean, that's pretty big stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, national TV is a hard thing to snag, you know, and so kudos to our team and our publicist for getting us on that episode, and kudos to CBS for featuring so much of the music. It wasn't like a little blurb. They gave us a lot of screen time, and we're grateful and ready for the next. And, you know, it certainly, man, it helps so much to do those things when you're not able to tour. So really grateful.
Two last comments, one from each of you. Devin, you posted on social media a really big F you to the haters. If anybody hears this record and still thinks that you are doing something that your forefathers did before you, they really need to check their ears and get a grip on reality, because sure, you have the name and sure, you have the pedigree based on those people who came before you, but this is miles different in many ways to what.
Yeah, I mean, you know what? At the end of the day, you know, yeah, I had a moment. I posted something. I think I took it down in 2 minutes.
But it was accurate, dude. It was accurate. I was clapping.
I didn't even see it. So,
yeah. But it, you know, it was 99% of the people that listen to our band and, you know, and give it a shot and come to the show and listen to the record, they get it. They understand it. And that's who we make music for. You know, the 1% that go over there and, you know, and him and haw about this and that, and, you know, who plays guitar better, who sings better, this and that. We don't play music for them. They're over there. They're the peanut gallery. It's right. You know what? Every band has a peanut gallery. The Stones have fans that are like, they haven't been good since 1974. We don't play for those people. We right. play for the other people. And really, at the end of the day, I think the thing that's going to, you know, the proof is in the pudding. The work is going to speak for itself. We enjoy doing the work. We enjoy making the music. We enjoy, this isn't a have to, this was a want to, at the utmost degree of a want to. And we're just happy that we really had chemistry, and we're happy that we put together such a fine group of cats, and, you know, so yeah, it very rare that I have a moment, but you know, I think we're on the right track. I think we're doing, you know, at the end of the day, we do things with sincerity, you know, and yeah. Some people will love it and some people maybe won't, but at least it's sincere. So
agreed. The only other comment I wanted to get from you, Dwayne, was the LA music scene and the LA, for lack of a better word, jam band scene. You know, there seems to be this rising tide of bands, and you played on a Pacific Range record, which is probably one of my favorite records of the year. But there's guys like Pacific Range that are playing. There's Mapache playing. There's a whole bunch of these bands from your neck of the woods that are doing amazing things. What can you say about that LA music scene that's kind of bubbling up now?
Well, I like Pacific Range a lot. I think they have a really good sound. They're nice kids, and I wasn't really do. I think I was home, and a friend of mine was helping manage them and hooked me up with them. And I was like, yeah, sure, I'll go. I'll play on something. But as far as the other younger jam bands, I haven't been there a lot because we've been touring. Right. And also I'm in Jackson, Wyoming a lot during the quarantine. So, but a lot of the other stuff that is really great that comes out of LA, the kind of the East Side stuff is kind of that Jackson Browne, Blake Mills, Dawes, kind yeah. of Jonathan Wilson, you know, people like that are, you know, Blake is an old friend of mine, and he's one of my favorite guitar players in the world, living or non-living. No, I mean, I would say he's definitely one of my favorite young guitar players. So yeah, there's a lot of good stuff in LA, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's not the stereotypical, it's not the Sunset Strip.
No, it's not. Guys, thank you so much for taking the time. I way overdid it again. I can't wait to see you guys again live sometime and hang out again. Thanks for this great record, and keep on keeping on, as they say.
Thank you so much, man.
Thank you.
Devin Allman and Dwayne Betts will always be linked to the legacies of their fathers, but the Allman Betts Band is a 7-piece band that delivers a new sound that goes well beyond past and sadly fading memories. We hope that they continue making records as good as Bless Your Heart well into the future. For more on the Allman Betts Band, visit AllmanBettsBand.com. Before we leave you, let's listen to another track off Bless Your Heart. Here is Pale Horse Rider.
There's a thousand maps just don't lead you anywhere anymore. There's 100 signs placed there to confuse you. And I've been lost for way too long. Baby, I need you. I just need you. For their views. Oh,
You've been listening to The Sound Podcast. Technical production by Adam Karsh and Andrea Ruse. Inspired by the music we love. For more, visit thesoundpodcast.com.